Great. Thank you for being here. I guess we're just going to commence this now. In a way, this panel has a kind of a long title, which is about the Obama era, greenhouse gases, clean coal, pollution trading, and carbon caps. I think it's really about what the question gets down to here is what the is addressing the question of how to establish a price for carbon. And I'm just going to say a few brief words, and I'm going to really turn it over to my panel here. I'm a journalist. I've been doing this kind of work for 30 years. And I just wrote this book called Carbon Shock, which is essentially about the economic consequences of climate change. And what I tried to do was to go around the world, and all of you are environmental journalists, are aware of this idea of externalized costs. This is like so embedded in the work we do that it's just like boring to even hear the word again. But after decades of hearing that word repeated in so many different forms, I decided I wanted to go out and tell the stories of what the stories are. What are these externalized costs that everybody keeps talking about? And what are they specifically when it comes to climate change? Because that is the central issue of climate change. If you actually look at what the last decades of negotiations have been, global climate negotiations, as well as in our own country, as well as in states in the United States, the central question is how to start paying those externalized costs now, as opposed to decades and decades and decades from now. I think we've reached a new point in the kind of climate debate, and you guys can take this on if you wish or anybody has comments. I think arguably the first period, going over the past, let's say, 30 years, you had the accumulation of scientific evidence about what this notion of greenhouse gases are. What are the waste processes from fossil fuels, and what kind of disruptions are they wreaking in the atmosphere? This was arguably the first 20 years of this, what we now call our climate understanding. And the next phase of the climate evolution has been an increasing sense that the consequences of this disruption in the atmosphere are happening not in some distant time in our future, not if you look back at the language even 10 years ago where our climate change was all about our grandchildren and our grandchildren's grandchildren, and right now it is about us now today and the kind of life and the conditions within which we are living and what the effects of this massive disruption are already happening in our current time. And I think now, and I think that understanding is slowly beginning to take hold. I think the third phase that we're in now is this notion of how much, there's been a huge debate about how much money it's going to cost to reorganize the grid, in a more green direction. I think there's increasing attention to the monumental cost of not acting. And that is, I think, a fundamental shift in the debate, which has actually really only happened in the past 6 months to a year. And probably many of you are familiar with the Risky Business Report that came out from some of the top Treasury secretaries, bipartisan group, anticipating the billions of dollars going to cost the American economy. Obama's Council of Economic Advisors saying it's going to cost tens and tens of billions of dollars more each decade that we keep emissions on the current trajectory. So the issue now is how are we going to deal with the costs right now of climate change? How are we going to put the money in, generate the money that we need to wean ourselves off fossil fuels, which is a dual task, one of which is to make renewable energy more on a more equal playing field with fossil fuel energy, two, to reflect the actual externalized costs of fossil fuels in the internal price. This is a fundamental battle right now. So I just wanted to kind of lay the table here about some of the issues we want to talk about, is because this is not as simple an issue as you might think. I'm not saying you'd even think that. But if you were to think that, it's not nearly as simple as you would have been thinking if you were to be thinking that. So needless to say, there are many levers. You think you followed? Good. Okay, so we're on the right track here. So I'm going to now turn this over to our esteemed group of panelists who are going to address these questions from different points of view. And after they'll each give a brief presentation about how they engage with this issue, the perspective they're at it coming from. And then I'll have some questions. Hopefully you have some questions, and we'll have an interesting discussion. That's the whole point here, is try to kind of parse out what the meaning of this kind of price of carbon might be. So first of all, to my right is, my immediate right is Pat Parento, a veteran professor of law in the environmental university. He works at the professor of law at Vermont Law School, which some of you may know is one of the primary environmental law academies. The primary academy of law for environmental law in the United States and possibly in the world.
Yeah, why not?
In the English speaking world. Yeah. Excluding the Napoleonic Code world. and also, by the way, for SEJ members, which I assume most of you are, there's a fantastic media fellowship program. Yeah. I hope it's still going.
Yes, it is.
Yes. I did that about 6 or 5 years ago. It's fantastic.
You get Summer to basically.
Yes. You take law classes at VLS with law students. Worth thinking about if you're here. It's a tremendous fellowship program.
I've done it twice.
You have? I got to work on my second. All right. So, and Pat also runs the Environmental Natural Resources Law Clinic, where he's been involved in very deep engagement with many environmental legal questions, and is also former counsel to the National Wildlife Federation and the Environmental Protection Agency. Second, in the middle over here, is Mark Trexler, who I had a great pleasure with talking with at great length in the course of reporting this book. He's been inside and outside the effort to establish a price for carbon in the creation of the carbon markets way from the very beginning. He was involved with, I believe, the first offset project back in 1988, working at the World Resources Institute. He started his own carbon consultancy firm in the 90s. Ended up working with EcoSecurities, which was one of the top carbon trading companies in the world. Left that to become a risk analyst for Det Norske Veritas, which in the highly obscure, but highly important world of offset verification is one of the top two firms in the world that deals with the validation and verification of emission reduction claims by projects that aim to reduce emissions and get credit on the international markets. Mark was one of their top analysts of risk at that position. He has now left that organization and has actually founded his own consultancy firm called the Climatographers, and they specialize in assessing risk, environmental risk, for businesses and institutions, public institutions, governmental organizations, to actually understand what the environmental risks are ahead. And he's based up in Portland, Oregon with that organization. And it's very interesting to talk about on questions of environmental risk in an economic context. And finally, over on my far right, Gary Furo has an enormous amount of influence over the California greenhouse gas law. Good to know who he is, because he's helping to write the rules. He's the president of the Climate Action Reserve, which actually administers the carbon market mechanisms that have been established by the state of California to attempt to leverage emission reductions in the state of California. You're all aware of AB32 and the laws that came as a result of that, and the carbon market to essentially the statewide cap and trade system. And Gary's been involved deeply in writing the protocols for the types of projects that are acceptable under this system and the offset protocols as well. So before that, he managed the Green LA program in the County of Los Angeles and worked at the Department of Water and Power in the Solar and Energy Efficiency Department. So he knows his energy. And so this is our esteemed panelists here. I'm going to turn it over to each of them consecutively to introduce themselves further and tell us their thoughts as we begin this journey to the heart of Price.
Thanks, Mark. So I come at this question, even though I'm an quote-unquote environmental law professor, is not chiefly an environmental problem. And the first thing we have to deal with is what to call it, because we're having a hard time figuring out what to call this thing that's happening. We started with global warming. We shifted to climate change. And now, increasingly, we're at what I think is a more apt description, which is climate disruption. So it's not change in the sense of maybe it's good or maybe it's not so bad or, gee, let's wait and see. So all of the natural cycles are still at work. We still have four seasons. You know, we still have El Nino and La Nina. We still have the jet stream, although it's sort of drunk and wavy these days. But, you know, everything in our system, our climate system, is still there. And now we have the human amplification factor, the steroid factor. Okay, so that's the way the scientists are talking about this. I'm a lawyer. I'm not a scientist. I don't play one on TV or anything like that. But I do accept the views of 97% of the climate scientists. These are the people that actually publish in peer-reviewed scientific literature I'm talking about, that humans are causing the increase in temperature globally that we've seen over the last 100 years, most of which has occurred within the last 50 years. That these impacts are already being felt everywhere. Our national climate assessment in the United States has made that case. The latest and last, I understand, massive report from the International Panel on Climate Change, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, AR5, says that to a 95, some have said 99% certainty, all these increases in warming are caused by humans, caused by greenhouse gases, the largest of which obviously is carbon dioxide. That these changes are severe already, with relatively slight warming of 0.8 degrees Celsius or 1.4 Fahrenheit for us Americans who don't like the metric system, and that everything that's there is baked into the system for 1,000 years. It's irreversible, and so we're facing what we like to call a wicked hard problem. So that's how I come at the question. Now, this is a math problem. So I'm going to throw a whole bunch of numbers at you in a very short period of time, which you're not going to be able to comprehend and fully process. But I'll set the stage for Mark to talk about how we actually get some of these numbers down. But we're up against the law of physics, folks. Okay, so we're not going to negotiate our way out of this. We don't negotiate with the climate. We don't decide how much pollution is okay in Lake Erie or Lake Champlain or the Gulf Zone or how many species we're going to save. We're not in that kind of a situation, okay? These are implacable numbers, so here they come. The AR5 report has accepted the latest science on how do we measure, what's the proper metric for measuring the effect of carbon in the atmosphere. Let's stick with carbon and try to, you know, make it as understandable as we can. And the number is 1 trillion gigatons. Metric tons, sorry, 1 trillion metric tons. That's the number. If you want to stay below 2 degrees Celsius average global warming in this century, which is the stated goal of the Framework Convention on Climate and all the signatories and non-signatories that came out of Copenhagen, That's the metric the scientists say. You go beyond 2 degrees Celsius, you're into very dangerous territory. Now, James Hansen will tell you we're already in dangerous territory. Michael Mann will tell you we're already in dangerous territory. Kevin Anderson will tell you we're... Okay, so some of the leading climate scientists in the world say we're already in dangerous territory. 2 degrees Celsius is really dangerous. And the further you go, it gets really, really, and put as many really's as you want, dangerous. Okay? So 1 trillion tons. If we can hold the cumulative loading of the atmosphere to 1 trillion metric tons of carbon, we have a 60% chance of holding temperatures below 2 degrees Celsius, right? How much have we used so far? Over half, 52% to be precise. What do we have left? 485 gigatons. That's your number. That's your budget. That's your cholesterol level. Okay? If you want to hit 2 degrees Celsius, how fast are we burning it? At the current rate, which is 2% increased CO2 per year, we'll bust the budget by 2035. Okay? Are we going to hold the 2%? Well, think India. Think China. Think Indonesia. Think of the developing world. Think of all the dark spots on the globe. They're going to stay dark? They're going to stay in poverty? Or not? How high these emissions are going to go? Nobody knows. We're on track right now to 3.2 to 5.4 degrees Celsius. That's the track we're on this century. You can't even begin to comprehend what the world looks like at 3.2, let alone 5.4. It's beyond, we're already beyond the experience of humans on the planet where we are today. We're beyond the Holocene. We're beyond the 10,000 years of the most stable climate in the Earth's geologic history. Already, we're in what a lot of scientists are now calling, and you've heard it, the Anthropocene, or the Anthropocene, whatever you want to pronounce it, right? That's where we are. We're in a new era, our era, the human era, okay? So what are our chances for actually achieving this budget I'm talking about? There's 5 times the amount of fossil fuels on the books of private and public corporations. This would include countries, Russia, Iran, etc. Over 5 times the amount of fossil fuels on the books to exceed that number right now. 90 corporations hold about 60% of those reserves. You think they're going to give them up? ExxonMobil just came out with a new report saying, for the first time in public, out loud, we accept the science of climate disruption. And we know we're part of it. And we're not stopping. We're not only going to burn everything we have on the books, we're committing $60 billion this year to find more in tar sands, in deep ocean deposits, and so forth. I only have a minute. Gosh, what can I not tell you? Where's it all going? 45% of the emissions are going into the atmosphere. 27% are going into the oceans. The oceans have been absorbing a lot of carbon and keeping it out of the atmosphere and keeping temperatures down. That's not a good thing, folks. Ocean acidification is real. It's dissolving the base of the food chain everywhere in the world. It's attacking the formation of calciform-forming organisms, coral reefs. Reefs are also under pressure from heat. Now they're under pressure from corrosive water, et cetera, et cetera. 27% into land. In 2012, where did the emissions come from? United States decreased by 26%. Hooray! Right? China increased by 71%. We decreased only because we're not counting what we're outsourcing to China. That's where most of our manufacturing base is. So the numbers aren't even real. And now they're going back up. So what can I tell you with 30 seconds? What the experts are saying is if you want to have a shot at holding temperatures even under 3 degrees Celsius, you've got to keep 3/4 of the known reserves in the ground. How we do that, ladies and gentlemen, is the challenge of the remainder of the generation that's in this room and many generations to come. How in the world are we going to keep fossil fuels in the ground? Obama, you know, the climate mitigation president, when he's done, the United States will be a net exporter of energy, fossil energy, okay? It's all of the above. It's drill, dig, develop, burn. And over here on the EPA side, try to reduce some of the emissions from coal-fired power plants. So I'm going to stop. There's lots more to talk about. Maybe we'll get into some of the other things, but I do have to give Mark a chance to tell you about some more positive things about how we can actually do something about this.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Really? I'm always the half-empty guy. Okay. Well, before launching into sort of carbon pricing per se, let me give one slightly different perspective on Pat's information. The chances of actually staying at 2 degrees are pretty slim at this point, slim to somewhere close to none. And in fact, we're so focused from a policy perspective and even from a technical perspective on what do we need to do to stop at 2, when in reality we're not going to stop at 2, that we're not even thinking about not getting to 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, you know, conceivably 8. And there's a very interesting argument to be made that the whole policy structure, from a risk perspective, if you think about this from a risk perspective, it would be far easier for us to start making sure we don't get to 8, we don't get to 7, we don't get to 6, and sort of start ratcheting that down rather than focusing so much on 2 that we just blow through 2 and get to 5 without ever having thought much about it. So from a risk perspective, we might want to be thinking quite a bit more about the sort of the tail of the risk distribution and not staying so focused on 2 just because the policy community is so terrified of talking about anything else because it suggests they failed. And no one wants to fail, so we're going to focus on 2 until we've passed 2. And that's just not a very risk approach, a very good way to approach the risk of climate change. But let me jump now into a little more on the cost and price of carbon. First, it's useful to think about the two in a different way, and it's not a perfect segmentation, but in some sense, the cost of carbon, it's useful to think about as what are the actual impacts of climate change, and the cost of carbon is of course, not just carbon. It's all the greenhouse gases equalized back to dollars per ton of CO2, usually. The price is sort of, if you're going to put a price on carbon through policy measures and other things, what is that price with the goal of reducing emissions? So the cost is sort of a damage function kind of thing, and the price is more of a policy function kind of thing. And that's just a useful way to distinguish between the two names. When we talk about cost, there's been a lot of discussion recently of the social cost of carbon, proceedings by the federal government, et cetera. The first actual administrative proceeding, I think it was in Minnesota, goes back more than 20 years. I was part of that proceeding to try and put a cost on the price of carbon. The Public Utilities Commission in the state 20 years ago was trying to figure out what's the price, what is the cost to put on carbon emissions for purposes of energy planning. And the number they came up with was anywhere from 25 cents to $1.25, which doesn't actually change a lot of behavior. And so, you know, the question of cost is a very tricky one, and it really brings to mind Einstein's quote, which I'm not going to quote exactly, but basically, when you're trying to solve a problem with exactly the same tools and philosophies that got you into the problem to begin with, it's a bit of a challenge. And so, you know, the reason we have climate change is because we have this huge externality that is external. And when you start approaching climate change from a cost-benefit perspective and sort of all the conventional economic ways of thinking, it's very attractive to do that, but it's also very risky. And you have to really understand what are you getting and what are you not getting when you're trying to use exactly the same tools to solve a problem that created the problem in the first place. And when you look at the social cost of carbon, right now in the U.S., we have, quote-unquote, an official social cost of carbon for federal decision-making that's now gone up to about $35 a ton. It's a little hard to figure out how that's being used and what it really means in the federal proceedings that it's been involved with. But there are people that argue that it's not $35 a ton, that it's really $200 a ton because of the risks involved. And it comes back to get to these numbers, first, you have to figure out what's going to happen with climate change, which has all sorts of uncertainties. Then you have to convert all of that to economic terms, which is very limiting because we only have data sets for certain things, then you have to discount all of that back to the present. And the beauty of an economic approach to climate change is that if you use the kind of discount rate that we tend to use every day ourselves and in companies, climate change disappears as a problem. It's just not an issue because we don't care about anything more than 15 years into the future. When you use even a 7, 8, 9% discount rate for your decision making and for social cost of carbon calculations, climate, who cares? We just don't care. Because it loses anything after 15, 20 years from now basically gets discounted to zero and doesn't play in the economic analysis. So it's a tricky area that you have to really understand what's being talked about. And it's very hard to argue that kind of approach really takes into account the subject of risk and what could go wrong here when we're talking about climate change, because there's a lot that could go wrong that is not in the models, that is not in the economic analyses, because no one wants to be accused of being alarmist. So, you know, most of the models, most of the economic analyses sort of use middle-of-the-road estimates for a lot of the key variables. They're not really giving you the long tail of the risk distribution. And it's the long tail of the risk distribution that really should terrify us. And that's why we buy home insurance. If you did all your planning on the basis of the middle-of-the-road assumptions, none of us would have home insurance because your houses just don't burn down that often. It's because you're concerned about the long tail of the risk distribution that you buy home insurance. And yet, we're not thinking that way about climate change. So let me move over to the price function for just a couple of minutes, and we'll get more into this in the discussion. A couple of interesting ways to think about price. First of all, there's always a price. So, for example, if you have a renewable portfolio standard, you can imply a carbon price to that renewable portfolio standard, which is useful because it means you can have sort of a common metric. And some of the calculations, for example, for the renewable energy portfolio in California imply a carbon price of about $200 a ton. So there wasn't actually a $200 a ton price required, but the policy mandates to have certain amounts of wind and solar, et cetera, were the equivalent of about $200 a ton. So that's just one small point. The key issue is impact. We're starting to hear more and more that that we need a carbon price, and all sorts of companies are signing letters about, yes, we need a carbon price. No one's talking about what carbon price do we need, because that's a much more controversial number. And the question is the carbon price changing behavior? Because a carbon price, just for the sake of a carbon price, who cares? And what would it actually take to change behavior? Those numbers vary. But in the electric utility sector, you'll start to see behavioral change around $30 a ton. In the transportation sector, you won't start to see behavioral change until over $100 a ton. So when we have carbon prices in the international market of $4, when we have carbon prices in the California market of $10, $11, $12, very real question about, is that carbon price changing decision-making? And if it's not changing decision-making, is it a big issue? And the last just point there is, it doesn't actually have to be an imposed carbon price. Expectations can do the job as well. So if we start to get people thinking that a carbon price is coming and that it will be material, and people start to factor that into their decision-making, it's another interesting way of getting at this issue without necessarily having Congress pass an actual carbon price, which is a very tough proposition. And I'll leave it right at that for right now.
Great. Gary, why don't you give us a sense of what this question
looks like? Yeah. So let me start by saying, maybe with taking from where Mark was, you know, in California, the approach to addressing climate disruption, climate change, global warming, however you want to term it, was very simple in a way. AB 32 is a 16-page law that says we're going to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions to 1990 levels by the year 2020. And that contrasts, of course, with Waxman-Markey, which was a 1,600-page law. And it really is simple in kind of the broad scope. And I've got an iPad here, and you know, these are seemingly simple devices, right? Simple, elegant, clean. But if you go under the hood of them, and I certainly don't want to do that, but if you go under the hood of it, it's a very complex mechanism. And AB 32 is kind of similar. the simple part of it is that we're going to do four things to address climate change writ large. And that is we're going to clean up how we generate electricity, so renewable energy. We're going to be much more efficient on how we use electricity, so energy efficiency is a key component. We're going to clean up the transportation sector, and what that probably means is that it's going to convert to electricity or other clean fuels, and those are the kind of the broad rubric. And then the fourth, on a global scale, is that you've got to address tropical deforestation. If you do those four things, you've solved the climate crisis. Of course, getting there is the hard part, right? And so what California has done is fairly unique. And California will be the first one to say, Governor Brown has been clearly said this, California is not going to solve this problem all by itself. We know that. That's not why we're doing this. We're doing this because we want to demonstrate a mechanism, the tools that will allow others to follow. And somebody's got to take the lead. Somebody's got to go out there and do something about it so that others can start to join the bandwagon. So we're taking a leadership role and bringing in partners. And that's why we're linked with Quebec now. And we've got an MOU with China. And we've got an MOU with Mexico. We're acting as an independent country. But the key thing is within the AB 32, of course, there's the renewable portfolio standard. Mark alluded to it, Mark Drexler. There are energy efficiency standards. California's always been on the forefront of energy efficiency. There's clean transportation rules. California has had the right under the federal law to enact its own vehicle emission standards. And then we're going to get to, and so those are all parts of it. And sort of the backstop, all of those things, is the cap-and-trade program. So the cap-and-trade program gets, I'd say, 90 or more percent of the attention. It's actually responsible for only about 20% of the emission reductions because all these other mechanisms are in place. But it's the most important because it's the sweeper. If we don't get as many clean cars as we think we're going to get, if we're not going to get as much efficiency as we're going to get, then we can continue to ratchet down the cap. And the cap is fairly simple. It has some unique aspects. But the way that it works is that any facility whose emissions are over a certain threshold, 25,000 metric tons annually, is subject to the cap. And so that's about 600 facilities throughout the state of California, 300 companies. It goes in two phases. The first phase was electricity generators and importers of electricity, and that's unique because we're now reaching beyond California's borders and saying if you're shipping electricity to California, the guy who brings that in is now responsible for your emissions outside of the state. And then it expands starting next year to transportation sector, and this is where it really goes big. Because this will be the first time in any cap-and-trade system that I'm aware of where transportation fuels are under the cap. And that is a big step, and it's been a controversial step in California over the last year as the oil companies have been fighting tooth and nail to prevent this threshold from being crossed. But the bill died. We're moving forward. The program then ratchets down. So a cap in general, as most of you probably know, says here's how much emissions are coming from all of these sources that are covered, and every year we're going to ratchet down the number of permits, they call them allowances, that go out to all of those sectors, and they've got to figure out how to reduce their emissions because there's going to be scarcity in the number of permits. And it reduces over time. By 2020, it'll be about a 15 to 17% reduction from where we are today under the covered sectors, maybe as much as 22, again, if those other things don't come through. And in the beginning, California can distribute these allowances in a number of ways. They can give them freely to companies. They can auction them off. Or they can, in some cases, give them to companies who then have to go auction them off. And California's doing all of those things depending on the circumstances of the economic sector. And I won't go into the details of that, but if you're interested, there's a lot that goes on there. The second thing that's unique about California is that it actually said, we're going to set a floor price for these allowances. So regardless of what they might trade in the market, if the market were completely unconstrained, we're going to say they have to be, at the outset it was $10 a ton, and that gets ratcheted over time in accordance with inflation. And that's a fairly unique measure, but that ensures there is at least some price signal. You know, we can have arguments, you know, to the end of the, until whenever, as to whether that's an adequate price signal, but that at least ensures there's some price signal. And to contain costs, there are things like banking of allowances into future years, but there's also the ability, and they make compliance over 3 years to sort of even out spikes. But there's also offsets, and that's a place where we've been particularly active. We issue about, we've issued about over 50 million offsets already. About a third of those qualify for use in the California cap and trade. The program, of course, is designed to have. And this is the point of cap and trade, and I'll conclude with this point. The program is designed to have the least disruptive economic impact possible on the consumers in California. Ultimately, all these costs get transferred to consumers while getting the most emission reductions. And we can, Mark laid out the sort of differences between cost and price, but the price of an allowance, the price to reduce greenhouse gases, is about $10 a ton. If you can get, if the social cost of that emission is $35 or $200, and you can buy that reduction for $10 or $12, that's economically efficient, and that's the point. And what the point for California, and I'll just conclude here, is that we want to we're working to show that this mechanism can work and it can be effective, and then you can actually grow your economy at the same time as reducing emissions. And that's what we're out there proselytizing now to all these other jurisdictions. Stop.
Thank you. Great. So we've got a little bit of a picture of what the ideas are, the goals we're going for.
Sorry. We've got some idea now of the big picture, essentially, the struggle to actually obtain a price for carbon. So I think I'm going to throw it open to you in a minute, but I do have a question. I want to bring it down to this, to two basic figures. Two figures, put them side by side with each other. actually, three figures. One is that the most resource economists estimate that it would take a minimum of $50 a ton to begin spurring any kind of transformation away from fossil fuels. And people understand what a carbon price would mean. You'd add $50 a ton to the price of coal or the price of gasoline in order to make renewables more equally competitive and drive the market in that direction. So if the minimum is roughly $50 a ton, and the fact is that guess where the highest price for carbon in the world is right now? State of California. It's actually the state of California through actually the program that that Gary works with. Of course, what is that cost? As Gary just alluded, the base price is $10 a ton. It can't go below. It's roughly going between $10 and $13 a ton. I think that's roughly fair. So basically, you have a price right now in California that's one-fifth of the price that most resource economists say is the minimum, at which point you start getting changes. At the same time, and I'm raising this as an actual question, at the same time, you have the United Nations, which actually tells us that basically over the next several decades, you need to kind of plow global-wide somewhere in the equivalent of $1 trillion yearly over the coming decades to make this transformation. This is an enormous amount of money. So the question is, aside from the kind of efforts that all of us are making to try to put our hands around this, how do we begin to take those numbers and turn them into actual money? And the California market is basically nowhere close to what a transformative figure would be. Is there a way to organize the system in such a way to get it higher? Does it have other kind of, are there other mechanisms that we can begin to think about in trying to drive a price that's actually going to have significant impact? And I just want to turn this over to you because I think that's the fundamental question now that we understand the mechanism of work. And then I think we'll open it up here. But I did want to raise this.
Go first. All right. Well, maybe I'll go first, and I'm sure Mark Trexler can expand on this point. But you know, I don't think we need. I would question the fundamental framework of that question itself, because as I indicated a little bit or alluded to in my remarks, I think there's a difference between price and cost. And we're at a point today where we're achieving emission reductions, real, verified, significant emission reductions, and we can obtain those for $10 or $11 a ton or less in the case of offsets. Those have the same societal benefit as reductions that you might pay $30 or $40 for or $50. But your question goes to whether or not we're leading fundamental transformative change in the economy. And I think the response to that is that we're at the very, very start of this program. We're at, you know, this started in 2012, 2013. It actually started to take effect. We've been doing it for less than 24 months now. I think if you imposed a price of $50 a ton on the economy today across the board, that would be an economic shock, and it wouldn't be necessary because you can get those emission reductions. There's something known as the McKinsey curve for achieving emission reductions, and it starts with emission reductions that are actually pay for themselves, they're cost effective, and it goes up to paying $200 a ton. We're on the low end of that curve. We're getting emission reductions that are cost effective today. We'll get to the point where emission reductions cost $50 a ton, I suspect, over time, but I don't know that we... Depends on how quickly we move up that curve, right, and how broadly we scope. But I don't disagree with the fundamental point, which is that we do need to transition out of fossil fuels, and we need to leave fossil fuels in the ground. You do that by having a price on carbon.
And Gary's point is absolutely right. The key question is, are you trying to nibble at the margin, which is what we're doing with most of the current programs, or are you trying to figure out, are we going to do something about climate change? And so, you know, if you're nibbling at the margin and looking for cost-effective reductions, sure, you can find low-cost reductions, and that's what we're seeing in California, and those are good reductions, et cetera, and that's fine. But the reality is that we're not building a price of carbon into the larger thinking in the economy, which determines what power plants are built, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the electric utilities for many years have had a process by which they have to come up with a price of carbon for purposes of their scenario planning, and they have sort of a percentage. There's an X chance of this and an X chance of this and an X chance of this. And they've, for many of them, sort of arrived at this magic number of $9 a ton for purposes of their scenario planning, which has sort of the beauty of having no impact whatsoever on what they actually do. So they have a price of carbon that has no effect on what their long-term resource planning looks like. So it's not really a matter of, and look, I did the first carbon offset project. I've worked on carbon markets and offsets for decades. But the reality is that carbon markets can be used to get us where we need to go. They are not being used to get us where we need to go. And what policymakers tend to forget when we design carbon markets is that there are 1,000 very smart people waiting outside the door to figure out how to game the system. And so when whatever rules you write, people will figure out how to game that system and will, up to date, have figured out how to undercut the environmental effectiveness of the system. And that's that. Up to this point, that's been a huge problem. One last point, though, in terms of Mark's point, when we talk about $10 and those are the market-based prices. There are countries that have $100 a ton carbon taxes in place that do have an effect. These are all in Europe, obviously. Even British Columbia has more than 10 in terms of a tax. So you can go a tax route, which is politically much more difficult. So here in the U.S., we tend to love markets. We think markets will solve all problems through the invisible hand. But to date, you know, we're finding that it to implement that market in a way that actually addresses the problem is much harder than it first appears.
You want to add something? No. Get some questions.
All right, cool. So let's have some questions from the audience. Cool. Okay, sir. I'm going to hand you the mic, and then you can speak into the mic and tell us your name.
we have to identify ourselves
when we answer. Morgan Robinson, documentary filmmaker. Just can you guys talk about the political process here? Because it seems like, in my mind, it's not so much like finagling the numbers that's the tricky part. It's convincing the world to do this.
Right. So the next conference of the parties, there's an interim meeting in Peru this year, but the next one, the big one, is in Paris in 2015. And under the framework convention, the 1992 convention, the plan was to have a treaty, a new treaty, to replace the Kyoto Protocol and broaden the number of countries that are actually making some kinds of commitments to do something on both the mitigation side, emission reduction, and the adaptation side, because we're in both situations right now. We've heard just recently from the Obama administration that there's not going to be a binding treaty coming out of Paris. No surprise there. That what they're hoping for is something that they don't have to take to the Senate to ratify, but that we can somehow make a pledge to. Don't know what the hell that is. Whatever comes out of it, it's going to be... it's going to have to involve some commitment from the developing world, which has been very hard to get, in exchange for money to the developing world for adaptation, which they desperately need and deserve. Whatever comes out of it isn't going to put us on a course to reach 2 or 3 or 4. It's going to put us on some course to get somewhere someday. It's going to be some progress. It's going to be very modest. We're just going to have to be satisfied with that. We have nothing near in the United States a political consensus to do anything serious at the national level. Lots of things happening at the state level, particularly California and other places. In my home region in the Northeast, we have REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, wildly successful in raising money. Money's being used to weatherize homes. Money's being used to help people reduce their fuel bills. Money's being used for all kinds of wonderful things. The actual reductions of emissions, very modest. Only the electricity sector. It's a cap-and-trade program, yeah, but it's mostly a revenue generation program, and that's good. That's fine. It's doing really good work. British Columbia has a carbon tax, revenue neutral. It's doing good. It's wildly popular, renewed and increased through referendum. The notion that, you know, carbon taxes are death to the economy, death to the human race, is bullshit. British Columbia has shown that. So all kinds of different sort of good things happening, 1,000 little twinkling lights all over the place happening, but nothing nowhere near the scale of what's needed on the horizon.
Great. Yeah, I think that's a very concise answer, hopefully. So, all right, take you and then you. Yeah, sorry, and then we'll open it up. Tell us your, sorry.
I'm Ashley Ahern. I work for NPR in Seattle and EarthFix. Hey, Pat. So I'm wondering about when you talk about carbon pricing and if the inability to set a national price on carbon. In the Northwest, we're looking at coal exports, which if they come through Washington, would dwarf the state's CO2 emissions once they're burned in China. And so it becomes a question of, in the absence of federal action on setting a price on carbon, what might that look like? Is there any way to, you know, policymakers are thinking about tackling the price of exporting our fossil fuel emissions as opposed to just managing them within our state borders or from across state borders as California has done with where you guys buy coal?
Great, thank you. Who wants to take that,
Mark? To my knowledge, I'm in Portland. I have been following that. I'm not aware of any. Even if you had a price on carbon, it's not clear to me that that would pass through. That would affect the coal exports that are being proposed.
I could kind of jump in here,
but very quickly. So it's sort of tying these two points together. To talk about the price of carbon as a solution is fundamentally problematic if you don't have any sort of political coalition to actually say we need to solve the problem. And as Pat said, we don't have that now. And to sort of hide that fact, we're focusing a lot of time and effort on talking about pricing carbon. But you're never going to get a carbon price that does the trick as long as you don't have the underlying political consensus. So it in some ways for next year, for the next conference of the parties, let's just declare victory now and declare victory, and then maybe we can actually talk about some of the difficult questions that are outstanding. Because what we're going to see between now and then, and what we're already seeing, is massive amounts of spin as to wouldn't it be great if all the countries of the world came together to voluntarily say what they'll commit to, and somehow this is better than regulation because it's sort of a homegrown mandate. But of course what that means is we're not actually going to see any significant reductions. And there's an interesting analysis that just came out from Henry Jacoby at MIT that actually quantifies what they think will come out of the Paris conference and sort of quantifying how it doesn't really do very much to bend the curve.
And I would just add, on your question of like the notion of exporting emissions, which is a very interesting part of this whole picture. And I visited a couple of cities that handle that in very different ways, and I wrote about this in this book. and in the city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and the city of Manchester, United Kingdom. What's very interesting in those two cities, post-industrial cities, all their industries basically moved, in the case of Pittsburgh, to China, in the case of India, Manchester to India, their greenhouse gas emissions plunged. Where did that industry go? There they are in China producing all the steel goods for export to Pittsburgh and broadly speaking the United States. And the same thing for textiles. Moved to India. They're exporting, they're producing greenhouse gases from textile factories in India and sending the textiles to England. So this is becoming a very fundamental question of negotiators of how to deal with this incredible discrepancy. And I guarantee you the Chinese are aware of this discrepancy. Because if you include the amount of emissions tied to exports in China, their emission total drops about 25%. About 25% of their emissions in China are due to products that are exported to the Europe and the United States. It changes the dynamic. And so in answer to your question, I think partly you're going to actually see more and more tension around these kind of questions. And as you get discrepancies in the way that carbon is priced, you're going to see higher and higher levels of trade tensions emerging, even the discussions of border tariffs and such like that, to deal with the fact that we in the United States have exported much of our emissions. And in the case of Washington, I think you've got that coal that you're exporting to China, which is a very similar question, because they're going to burn the coal in China and then export the goods to America. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I don't know. No, I need to add a lot on that, and I think you alluded to it at the end here. But California is actually now experimenting with the idea of a border carbon adjustment, which is a tariff for imported goods. And so if you're importing cement from someplace else that doesn't have a carbon price, we add that carbon price onto the cement as it comes in. We haven't done this yet, but that starts to get to that that idea of these trade issues where you are exporting the emissions.
Another question?
I'm Tim McDonald from Mother Jones. And Mark, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the challenges in the offset verification that you've been working on and kind of how you see that progressing as if we do see more carbon markets emerging in different parts of the world, you know, what are some of the challenges for verifying that those are actually doing what they say they are?
And at the risk of a bit of heresy, it's not a verification issue, generally speaking. That's not where the problem is. The problem is in the actual policy that is guiding the market that you are then verifying. Because what has happened to date in the international markets, for example, is that, you know, the protocols for emissions reductions are all agreed upon by, quote unquote, the policy bodies. The verifiers only come in at the very end to find out whether you are following that protocol. They're not there to decide, is this a legitimate reduction? They're simply there to say, have you followed the protocol that you were approved under? And the real problem isn't in the verification. I mean, there have been various scandals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In most cases, those were paperwork scandals. They weren't nefarious scandals. The real problem is that many of the protocols are simply written in such a way that a lot of the reductions that are approved under those protocols aren't real. And so when you're setting up a carbon market, you really should be making some very difficult decisions at the very beginning as to, do you want to, well, without getting into type 1, type 2 error, you know, you cannot have a perfect carbon market. Everyone assumes just design a perfect carbon market. And you can't. I mean, the more you squeeze down the fake stuff and raise prices, the more you're allowing, the more you squeeze down the fake stuff, the higher the price is going to be, and the more you're also squeezing down the real stuff. Because it's not possible to distinguish reliably would this have happened, would this not have happened? So the real problem that we've had with markets is not on the verification side, it's that we haven't been willing to decide up front what kind of a market do we want and what kind of a price are we willing to pay. That's a policy question, and policymakers always say, oh, we'll just let the technology people figure that out in the market itself, and they can't figure it out.
To follow up on that, Gary, you can pick this up too. Is that a phenomenon arising from this collision of motives to create offsets? On the one hand, you have the motive to keep the prices low, which is why you have an offset system to begin with. On the other hand, you're trying to actually find a way to reduce emissions. So you have this collision. I mean, basically, offsets exist because they can actually lower the price. So the only way to lower the price is to, as you say, create great variability in the quality and the lack of certainty in the offset itself. So this, I guess, and this would probably go to you too, Gary, which you may want to address, is this question of if offsets are there to reduce the price, I guess the question is, how far do you want to reduce the price, which relates to the quality and the integrity of the offsets? And I think that gets to your question too. Yeah.
Yeah. So let me start by saying that offset quality isn't necessarily driven by price, because you can produce a very low cost offset in a number of sectors that's very high quality. So in this instance, I don't think cost or price and quality necessarily are correlated. That said, I think it is very, very difficult. Mark is right, and he's got great expertise in this, to write a standard that accurately assesses whether or not a particular action would have occurred in the absence of the incentive provided by the offset market or by the carbon market. That's the work that we've taken on at the Climate Action Reserve. That's what we do day in and day out. We've written 15 standards that we think do that, and we're constantly revising them to improve them over time, because they're never perfect and they do need to be improved. California has adopted 5 of those standards, and only 5 of those standards, for its market, which, if you contrast with the CDM or the, under the UN protocol, some several hundred methodologies that have been approved by the United Nations, California is taking a very measured, very deliberate approach to ensure that only those real reductions get into its system. And it's not necessarily a verification issue. It is a standards issue. So it's a challenging question. We've done it completely differently than anybody else. I sound like I go blah 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 California, blah 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 California, but
we got to this point.
We pioneered what are really called performance-based standards. So everywhere else that you look at, what's the internal rate of return for that particular project, that particular actor, determine whether or not this is something that is economic or not economic for that individual. That's highly subjective and inefficient. We've said this is sort of business as usual. This is what's required by regulation. This is the bar at which we're going to set the standard. And if you do better than that, we are certain that you are additional. Now, maybe there are some who are doing that because they're just good do-gooders, but by and large, they are, in fact, additional. And that's a completely different way of assessing it. You assess it on the sector as a whole rather than for each individual actor.
Let me just be the skunk at the party for a minute, because if I had Mark or Gary running my offset program, I'd feel very comfortable and sleep well at night. The truth is that when theory hits reality, something happens. So the clean development mechanism, you know, under the framework agreement was the primary mechanism for investing in developing countries so that they could grow clean, provide jobs, do all the good things they're supposed to do, and reduce carbon. Well, the clean development mechanism is almost dead at this point. And part of the reason is this is a counterfactual problem, okay? Would the thing that you are seeing happen, would it have happened if you hadn't created the offset program? And it is a fiendishly complicated metric to figure out, okay? It looks good on paper. It doesn't look so good in reality. But I'm not saying we shouldn't do it and shouldn't learn, and hopefully we've learned some of the mistakes. I mean, the CDM program, the biggest problem there was people figured out that they could create very potent greenhouse gases as a secondary product of the manufacturing process they were creating so they could sell these incredibly valuable credits, which was totally perverse. The system and the manufacturing plants in China that produce these things would never have been built if it hadn't been for the CDM, you see? So they created greenhouse gases and then they sold them. So you do have to watch out. I'm not saying California's program is going to do that, don't get me wrong. REGGIE also has a very, very modest offset program. It's less than 1% can be used for offset. So I just want you to know it really is a difficult equation.
Thank you.
Okay. So we have time for a couple more. Let's take three questions. I'll take the three here.
I'd just like to follow up briefly with a question that relates to that. Is I would ask if you would, given the devil is in the detail, there's basically three different ways you can put the price on carbon. One is regulatory, one is through a carbon tax, one is through cap and trade. And, of course, there's been a lot of talk about by some economists that, like, the carbon tax is some promised land or something. But it seems from what you're saying, and I'd like you to comment on this, is that what's most important isn't which mechanism you use, because you alluded to, Gary, the regulatory approach that was getting 80% of it, but how you design it, whether it's a regulation, whether it's cap and trade, or whether it's a carbon tax, it's how you design it, not right, which one. That's my question.
Let them address it and do it quickly, because we are running out of time.
I agree. I'll let them talk.
and just one very quick, and that's absolutely right, and one very quick point, especially when you're talking about carbon tax. Again, it's not as if we have to impose a high carbon tax today to have a big impact tomorrow. The issue is expectation of carbon price for decisions that are being made. So you could actually put in a very modest carbon tax today as long as you have some sort of certainty as to the price tomorrow, which raises the question, can you ever actually have certainty of anything if policymakers can get a hold of it? But that's a slightly different question. It's the expectation of carbon price that drives decision making rather than necessarily today's carbon price. So that's also just a twist on that.
Clear, steady signal, not, you know, smoke signals in a high wind.
Yeah. Or think about how businesses deal now in America. You've got like carbon price in California, you got a vague carbon price in New England, you got maybe a carbon price coming out of the Midwest somewhere. It gets very chaotic. Anyway. Yes.
Thank you. I'm Christy George. I'm a freelancer from Portland, Oregon. And last night at dinner, we were talking about climate and what to do, and I made the joke that don't we have to address the economic systems, the capitalist systems that created a lot of the problems to deal with climate change? And we were talking about it in the context of the moral issues that are embedded in the current economic system. So that's my question.
See, Gus Fett.
I've seen them. All right. Anybody want to take on the moral characteristics of the capitalist order?
Well, two things. One, think of climate change as a million-piece jigsaw puzzle. There is no single approach or no single answer here that sort of solves this problem. We've got to be using all sorts of things. Unfortunately, you know, we don't talk much about population, and right after that comes sort of the underlying economic system. And you do have people like Gus Beth and others who are saying, well, wait a second, and this goes back to the Einstein comment, you know, how do you solve a problem with the same tools that created the problem? But generally speaking, the environmental community is sort of avoiding that question, like, you know, with a 10-foot pole.
I would also put this quickly, and I don't want to turn it over to her, that if you look at this historically, what's interesting historically is that it's really like 200 years, we had the Industrial Revolution 200 years ago, right? That was a fantastic moment when we developed these new forms of energy, coal, oil, that actually we learned how to power machines and the new things that made our modern lives, what we have today, civilization, as we know it, possible, right? This was a tremendously thrilling invention. And it took about, 50 years and a little bit of Charles Dickens to actually understand what the acute effects of the pollution was from the coal plants and et cetera, the soot in London and the dark moths and all the other stuff that we now know was the other effect of the Industrial Revolution. That was acute pollution. Now it's been 200 years. It's only been in the last 30 years, perhaps, roughly speaking, that we've understood the enormous collateral effects in terms of the chronic effects of this Industrial Revolution that we went through. And I think we're in the middle of that phase now, trying to deal with our growing knowledge, which is relatively new, as to what the ultimate impacts of this Industrial Revolution were. Whatever you think about capitalism, communism, it's basically the phenomenon of this revolution. Ma'am.
Hi, this is Maureen Nandini Mitra from Earth Island Journal. This is going a little bit into the weeds, but I wanted you all to address forest offsets from the forest sector, which are predicted to be the largest sector from which you're going to get carbon offsets, and also among the most problematic because it's really hard to verify how much carbon a tree or a forest is capturing because of various issues. And I just want to know what the panel's opinion on forest offsets are.
Gary and I had some interesting interactions.
Yeah, I'll start. I think there's a couple of, I look at forestry in sort of two broad categories, and there is, of course, what are we doing about tropical deforestation throughout the Amazon and Indonesia and elsewhere? And that, I think, is a very difficult question, because the question is, what is the base you're measuring against in terms of how much has been avoided that isn't getting cut down? Forest carbon in general, I think, there's part two, which is more domestic, which is our familiarity. We've written the first forest protocol that was adopted by a regulatory body, which was adopted by the California Air Resources Board, and it's an improved forest management tool. So it really looks at how are you managing your forest? Are you managing that forest to increase the total amount of carbon over time? Measuring carbon is not difficult in a forest. Foresters, timber owners have been doing this for a long time. They just call it timber. They don't call it carbon. Same thing. It's in the trees. And they have very good tools for knowing how much timber they have on their land. The hard part and the most difficult part is really protecting it over the long term. Because the idea of a forest offset is that it has to mitigate against a ton of pollution that gets emitted today. And that ton of pollution that gets emitted today stays in the atmosphere essentially forever, which means you've got to keep that ton of carbon in the forest for essentially forever. We've done that by calling forever 100 years. That's close to forever in some people's terms. And it's probably adequate from an environmental perspective, from an atmospheric perspective. We're at year two, so we don't know what it's going to look like 50 years from now, 60 years from now, 80 years from now, when we're trying to enforce rules that we impose today.
And
there are a lot of problems with forest offsets abroad with indigenous people in forest land. Yeah. And places like
yeah.
Africa.
But very just
yeah
just,
no
but,
there just, and just yeah
just very quickly on the forest offsets aren't inherently better or worse than any other offset. There are good ones and there are bad ones, and there are forest offsets one could do, very high quality, et cetera, areas of high biodiversity that we're inevitably going to lose. When you move down from those and get into more and more and more questionable forestry offsets. And that's where we've tended to go, because a lot of people perceive there to be an economic opportunity in those questionable sectors. So it's not that it's exactly the same questions. We could do very high quality forestry offsets. A lot of the forestry offsets that have been done are not high quality forestry offsets.
Obviously, that's a good question, because this is, yeah, we're out of time. And if you want to continue this, California, of course, is at the forefront of the country in terms of actually dealing with forest offsets as part of the program. Which,
about the logging industry.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming.
Hey, thank you very much. Hopefully this was interesting. Many components.